thinking that's the best way to do it. The doors open and I step out, pretending to myself that I'm alone, praying Taryn will keep quiet while I get my bearings. It's late, you're exhausted. You've just driven from the airport. This is easy. I remember. I stood here, looked at the numbers and arrows painted on the walls, realized I had to turn left around the corner behind... Shit, not so easy after all. What is it? Taryn pounces. Out of the lift, turn left around the corner. That part is right, definitely right. And the dead end, also correct. There's a problem, though. There are two doors in front of me, not one. Rooms 324 and 325. Aren't you going to...
Hush, Sally! I'm not saying a word, not yet. Kara, which room was it? Which of the two?
I don't know. I don't remember there being two doors. I only remember one.
Maybe some ghostly guests have been adding on new rooms as well as erasing information from the computers, says Zelly.
Obviously not, I say. It comes out flatter and harder than I intended. Obviously both these rooms were here last night, but I didn't notice the second. I saw only what I needed to see, the door I needed to open to find the bed I was going to sleep in, or so I hoped. And I can't remember which door that was. I'm sorry.
You'll be even sorrier in a second, says Taryn. Come here.
She beckons me back toward the lifts. When I get to where she's standing, she says, Okay,
what do you see?
Tell her you're not prepared to play games. The lifts, a corridor, a grey carpet, a framed picture of the Grand Canyon on the wall.
Okay, stop. How many elevators do you see, or lifts, as you Brits call them?
What's wrong with her? Isn't it obvious how many?
Two.
Two?
Taryn squeals. Seriously? I'm looking at two. You asked me what I could see. I know there are others behind me. Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Taryn claps her hands together. She grabs hold of me and whirls me around.
And what do you see now? How many elevators?
Oh, God, I can't believe I've been so stupid.
Two elevators this side, two that side, says Taryn. You remember getting out of the elevator and turning immediately sharp left into a corridor with a dead end. But look, there's a dead end over there, too. Rooms 322 and 323, exactly the same, a mirror image. You remember you were in the elevator on the left, not the right, but there's a left and a right on both sides. You could have come out of the one on the left, on either side, turned left around the corner, and found yourself in a dead end looking at two doors. I'm guessing from the look on your face that you don't remember which side you got in on the ground floor. I shake my head. After you pressed the button, while you were waiting for the elevator to come, what could you see? Taryn persists.
I don't remember. Lift doors, I suppose. I want to lie down on the floor and cry. How do I get away from these people, from this situation?
Yeah, but on the ground floor, they're mirrored on the outside, right? All fancy-schmancy. Looking one way, you'd have seen the doors to the Sunset Grill restaurant reflected. Looking the other way, you'd see the little fake shop. You know the one I mean?
Fake shop?
Wow. Kara, do you not notice anything? Big glass bulge in the wall, with gold shoes and diamond-studded handbags inside? There's a poncho in there that I wanted to try on, and no one could get inside the goddamn glass case for me. There's supposed to be a key, but could I find a single staff member who knew where it was?
Poor dear Mama, says Zelly. It must be so hard to be you.
Well, I'm sorry, but what the hell is the point of having a glass bubble stuck to the wall with merchandise inside it that you want people to buy, and then, when they want to look at it, you can't find the key?
I don't remember seeing anything reflected in the lift doors, I say. I was knackered. I was barely looking, barely aware.
Well, we've narrowed it down to four rooms, I guess. That's better than nothing.
Taryn squeezes my arm.
It hurts. And Zelly and I can help out. We can get it down to three.
How?
Taryn walks over to the door of room 325, pulls a keycard out of her shorts pocket, and holds it against the metal pad. A green light flashes and the door opens. The room you went to wasn't this one, she says. This one's ours. Mine and Zelly's. No, I refuse to believe it. Something's not right. Taryn's holding the door open, waiting for me to come in. Zelly's already inside, kicking off her sandals. Are you coming in or what? Says Terran. We'll ring reception and get the names from Rihanna. The guests in the other three rooms, then order room service. Aren't you starving? I could eat a fucking horse. With guac fucking mole, obviously. No chance of the horse arriving without, not at this resort. We can eat on the balcony. There's plenty of room. Kara? 325 is your room. Well, yeah. I mean, that's why I'm in it. Problem? Why didn't you tell me? Taryn's mouth flattens into a line. Tell you what? Tell you when? I have told you, I just did. When I said I remembered the room Rihanna sent me to was on the third floor, why didn't you say then that your room's on the third floor? It's irrelevant. Why would I mention it? There must be 50 rooms on this floor. I didn't know we weren't easily going to be able to get the number of the room you got sent to, and I didn't know you'd end up narrowing it down to four rooms that included mine. Satisfied? Taryn's hand is on her hip now. My doubts are delaying her dinner. I don't know if I'm satisfied. I'd like a chance to think without her watching my every move. Of course, I say. If I play nice, it'll be easier to get away. Listen, I'm going to go back to my casita. I'm not especially hungry, and I need to do a few things, so...
What things?
Don't you want to know who's in the other three rooms? Yes, but I really just need... Taryn's burst of laughter cuts me off.
You really just need to learn to speak your mind. You don't want to have dinner with Zell and me.
Fine, I don't care. If you suspect me of hiding Melody Chapa in my hotel room because it's one of the four in your lineup, go right ahead. I'm not offended. I think it's hilarious.
I just want to be on my own for a bit, that's all. Why do I sound as if I'm pleading with her?
Okay, well, I'm going to find out who's in those other three rooms, and if the police are on their way, I want to know what the hell's going on. Don't you?
Behind her, Zelly appears with her strawberry blonde hair up in a bun on top of her head. She glances at me, makes sure I register her not-impressed look, then opens the door behind Taryn. It juts out into the narrow entrance corridor, blocking my view of the room. I hear the sound of a tap running and smell vanilla.
I don't think you and I can find out very much, I tell Taryn. She's right, I should be more straightforward instead of always trying to smooth things over.
We've got no authority to ask questions. If there's anything dodgy going on, the police will sort it out.
Yes, like you, I want to know what's going on. Of course I do. This is the most bizarre thing that's ever happened to me. I'm as intrigued as you are, but I don't think we're going to get the answer today.
Taryn's biting the inside of her lip. You know what? I'm not sure the Arizona police are the guys we need right now. They've already been and gone. No surprise there. Melody Chapa was murdered in Philadelphia. What the hell does that have to do with them?
Not their problem.
If Mrs. McNair's right and Melody left Swallowtail last night, I don't believe any Arizona cop is gonna find out she was ever here in the first place. Their life's much easier if they don't find that out. See what I mean? Something as big as this that crosses state lines.
That sounds federal to me.
Are you saying you think we should contact? I leave the question unfinished. I'd feel too silly saying it.
Yeah, the FBI.
This is too much for me. Way too much.
I have to go, I whisper. Sorry.
Kara? Kara? Are you actually running away from me? Oh my God. The lift comes quickly, thankfully. I don't allow myself to breathe until the doors are shut and I'm moving away from Taryn Fry and towards safety. Back in my casita, I order room service. A chicken Caesar salad and an orange juice. To come in exactly an hour and a half. I feel my face heat up as I specify my desired delivery time, even though Swallowtail is the kind of place where you can do that, and no one will bark. Look, you'll get your food when you get it, okay? I run myself a bath, wishing I had some of Zelly's vanilla oil or whatever it was she was using. Instead, I make do with a little bottle of Swallowtail bath and shower gel that smells of eucalyptus and something citrusy. I pour it into the hot running water, breathing in the scent. God, that's good. Who needs vanilla? While I wait for the tub to fill, I walk around my casita. It's still as beautiful as it was when I was last here. I didn't imagine it. I touch walls and countertops, feel the softness of rugs and the cool tiles against the soles of my feet, and make a point of not thinking about Taryn Fry, Melody Chapa, Bonnie Juno, Christy Revel. I didn't know any of those names yesterday, and for the time being, I intend to pretend that I still don't. I should check Instagram, Jess or Ollie might have commented on the photos I posted earlier. The thought of looking, of facing up to whatever my children might want to say to me, is terrifying. I also need to see whether Patrick's replied to my email. I swallow hard. I'm so tempted to put off the moment of reckoning until later, to have my bath and dinner first. But if I do that, I won't enjoy either. And if I don't, if I look now, I might be too upset to eat. You didn't really think you could leave it all behind, did you, Kara? My hands perform the necessary actions while my brain blanks out. It's the best way, the only way. I have to know what's there waiting for me. My whole body sags when I see it's good news. Well, not news, really, but certainly good. Definitely not bad. There's no email from Patrick, but there's a comment from Jess under one of the pictures I posted. That must mean she stayed up late. Later than I'd have allowed. It's 7:30 p.m. in Arizona, so 8 hours later in England. 3:30 a.m. She left her comment at what would have been midnight her time. Beneath my photo of the two colourful cocktails, she's written, "Yeah, looks great, thanks for not taking me with you. Dad and Ollie have been driving me mad. Ollie's an infuriating little squit. Why did you go off without telling us? WTF is going on. Are you and Dad breaking up? You better not. Dad is incapable of doing proper parenting, BTW. Me and Ollie are at Granny's. It's too hot, none of the windows open, and there are radios talking shiznit in every room. She leaves them on all the time. Come back. XXXXXX. Ollie and I, not me and Ollie. Incapable, not incapable. I start to cry, missing home. Happy that Jess sounds like Jess. She's okay. They're okay. Everything will be fine. Somehow. On her Instagram, Jess has posted a photo of a closed window with paint peeling off its frame. I recognise Patrick's mother's house. Ollie always sleeps in the attic room and Jess in the main guest bedroom. I leave a comment beneath the picture. I will come back soon, on Tuesday, 24th October. Dying to see you, darling. Lots of love to you and Ollie. XXXXX. And no, Dad and I are not breaking up, I promise. Can I promise that? Too late. The comment's up. Patrick wouldn't leave me and the kids, no matter what. Not even if I make him have one more child than he wants. Are you sure about that? Taryn's words come back to me. I'd say you have a problem of some kind and you don't know how to solve it, which proves you're unimaginative. There must be a way to deal with it. If I knew the problem, I'd give you the solution. Please, God, spare me Taryn Fry's prescription for how to improve my life. I flop in my scented bath for an hour, looking at the list of activities on offer at Swallowtail. If there were a workshop on decision-making, I'd consider signing up. What to do in impossible situations, or something like that. My chicken Caesar salad arrives with an unasked-for bowl of guacamole, which makes me think about Taryn again. I wish I hadn't made it so obvious that I suspected her of deliberately deceiving me. Thinking about it rationally, she's right. There was no reason for her to say, "Wait, third floor? That's where my room is," when I first mentioned it. I don't honestly believe Taryn and Zelly are hiding anything. Anything in this case being an officially dead girl whose parents are in prison for her murder. The idea is laughable. Embarrassing. I'm going to have to find Taryn at some point and apologize. In my desperation to extricate myself from her overbearing clutches, I overreacted. Finishing my food, I push my plate aside. I wish I could push my thoughts away as easily, stop them from circling back to Melody Charper. She must be dead. There was a whole trial, huge amounts of money spent, no doubt, on prosecuting, defending, appealing. It was all over the media for years. The whole of America can't be under the illusion that this girl is dead if she isn't. It's impossible. That ought to be my starting point. Or even better, not mine, someone else's. Ownership is the last thing I want. This is nothing to do with me. I want to find out the end of the story, though. Who was the surprise guest on Bonnie Juno's show? The one who changed everything and caused suspicion to shift from the Revels to Annette and Naldo Charper? I reach for the iPad and type the names Bonnie Juno and Melody Charper into the search box together. Some of the first results that come up are YouTube clips. The top one, as well as the most recent, is dated 2014 and has the tagline, "Bonnie Juno talks Melody Charper on the Ken Hayen Show.
The Bloody Sock Controversy. I click on the white arrow, and the clip starts to play.
Bonnie Juno interviewed by Ken Hayen, CNN, June 23, 2014.
KH.
My next guest needs no introduction. Welcome, Bonnie Juno. Thank you for being with us today.
BJ.
Always a pleasure, Ken. Thanks for having me on the show.
KH.
I didn't expect a yes from you, Bonnie. I'll be frank. I thought you'd said all you had to say about Annette and Naldo Chapa.
BJ.
I thought so too, Ken, now that justice has been done and those two evil monsters are behind bars where they belong. But certain other people determined to bury their heads in the sand, keep putting misinformation out there like it's going out of style, and I can't let that go unchallenged, for poor little Melody's sake, for the sake of her memory.
KH.
Well, I guess I can understand.
BJ.
Even with her murderers behind bars, injustices can still be perpetrated against her, and that's what I believe is happening here. This latest outpouring of trash from Ingrid Allwood, I refuse to call her doctor, she doesn't deserve the title, is the perfect example of...
KH.
Bonnie, I'm glad you raised Dr. Allwood's recent opinion piece. We did invite Dr. Allwood to join us here tonight. Unfortunately, she declined our invitation.
BJ.
Yeah, I just bet she did.
KH.
For those of you at home who missed it, we're talking about Dr. Ingrid Allwood's article in the New York Times.
BJ.
It's not an article, Ken. It's a piece of worthless trash. Just because it's made out of words doesn't make it any better than trash. It's an insult to poor little Melody is all it is. I swore to myself I'd always defend her interests to the best of my ability, and that's why I'm here today. What Allwood's doing? It's all lies. Dangerous lies designed to attract sympathy for Annette and Naldo Chapa. Hey, I've got news for the American public. Some people in prison are actually guilty, whatever you enjoy watching on your TVs. All these shows about the system framing innocent people, they're twisting people's minds. A little girl is dead, the right people are locked up, and I'm determined to keep it that way.
KH.
Bonnie, you clearly feel passionately about this.
BJ.
Damn straight.
KH.
Sure. But can we talk about a specific point raised by Dr. Allwood in the New York Times? Melody Chapa's sock with the blood on it? She says...
BJ.
No, Ken, sorry to cut you off, but you're already wrong, I'm afraid. Allwood doesn't say anything at all. That's the problem. She has no conclusions or even theories to offer. She doesn't seem to think the Chapas are guilty of murder, but neither will she admit to suspecting Christy and Jeff Reville. Who does she think did it, then? Santa Claus? She asks plenty and answers nothing. That in itself is highly misleading. Just leaves those questions hanging there. It's a rhetorical trick, and most people are too dumb to see it. She's trying to make everyone think that the answer, if only we knew it, would surely point to Annette and Naldo Chapa's innocence.
KH.
Wait, let me drill down a little here. No, please, I really want you to address this key point that Dr. Allwood made. To do that, we're going to need a recap of the uncontested facts. Nate Appleyard saw the sock with blood on it, a child's white sock, inside Christy Reville's car on the day that Melody went missing. But when detectives searched the car, the sock wasn't there. Sometime later, forgive me, I can't recall the exact length of time, but it was some weeks, I think, a bag was found that turned out to be Melody's school bag. Am I right so far?
BJ.
Entirely correct.
KH.
Okay. Inside Melody's school bag, the sock was found, stained with blood that turned out to be Melody's. Nate Appleyard was asked by detectives if this was the same sock he'd seen in Christy Reville's car, and he positively identified it. Same stains in the same places, no question about it.
BJ.
Yeah.
KH.
And so Dr. Allwood raised the question, and I must admit it seems a valid one to me. Let's say Annette and Naldo Chapa wanted to frame the Revilles.
BJ.
That's exactly what they wanted. They set the whole thing up and it nearly worked. Poor Christy Reville, who'd always been a good neighbor to them, taking care of their little girl while Annette was too busy with her high-flying career. Annette and Naldo Chapa were prepared not only to kill their poor sweet daughter in cold blood, but also to frame an innocent couple who'd never done them any harm. That's why I call them the embodiment of evil, and I'll stand by those words till the day I die. They make my skin crawl.
KH.
So, let's imagine for a second that you're the Choppas, you've murdered your daughter, and you want to frame Christy Reville. You somehow manage to get Melody's blood-stained sock inside Christy's car. That's quite a coup, right? Christy Reville told detectives categorically that she always locked her car, that she never forgot. She was very security-conscious, especially when she visited her masseur, Victor Sutar, who lived in a down-at-heel neighborhood.
BJ.
Look, Ken, I believe Christy thinks she's telling the truth there. I believe she thinks her memory's 100% accurate on that point, but I think she's wrong. We all make mistakes once in a while, leave things unlocked that we could have sworn we locked up safe and sound. When Christy visited Victor Sutar the day Melody disappeared, she left her car unlocked. Annette and Naldo Choppa, having murdered their daughter, drove to Sutar's place and planted that blood-stained sock in Christy's car. Christy was emotional that day, remember? She was losing faith in Sutar's ability to help her conceive a child. Locking her car would have been the last thing on her mind.
KH.
Well, with respect, Bonnie, that's your hypothesis. That she didn't lock her car and that the Choppa parents planted the bloody sock. No one saw them doing that, did they?
BJ.
That's correct. No one saw them. The other part? Incorrect. It's not only my hypothesis. It's also the verdict of a jury and therefore the hypothesis of the American judicial system, which I respect even if you and Ingrid Allwood don't. If Annette and Naldo Choppa murdered Melody, I'm saying if to indulge you, Ken, we both know it's not an if anymore, then of course they planted the sock. How else did it get inside Christie's car? Doesn't matter that no one saw them, we know it must have happened.
KH.
But then the sock moved, didn't it? It didn't stay in the car. It ended up in Melody's school bag, which was later found in some long grass near a local gas station. You'd say Annette and Naldo Choppa must have moved it, I assume, and Dr. Allwood asks, why would they do that? Putting that sock in Christy Reville's car, that's a successful piece of framing, isn't it? Nate Appleyard saw it, and if it had stayed in the car, the police would have found it sooner than they did on the property of Christy Reville. So why move it? Dr. All was right, isn't she? There's no reason for the Choppas to want or need to do that.
BJ.
You see, this is the danger with these questions, Allwood, and now you leave hanging.
KH.
What danger?
BJ.
You only take the thought process so far, just far enough to cast doubt. It's sickeningly dishonest. Let's take it further. If the Choppas had no reason to move Melody's blood-soaked sock, that might mean they're innocent, right? Okay, let's go with that. If they're innocent, that means someone else abducted and murdered poor little Melody. Either Christy and Jeff Reville or somebody else must have done it. Can we agree on that?
KH.
I think so, yes.
BJ.
Let's say Christy and Jeff did it. So, the sock's in their car because they're guilty as all hell and they decide to move it to where? A bag that's covered in Christy's DNA? Okay, she often took Melody to school and must have held her bag a lot, but still, this bag's covered in Christy's DNA and full of Melody's blood, her hair which shows evidence of arsenic poisoning, flies that must have come into contact with her dead body? I'm sorry, Ken, I can't help it. I don't know how anyone can talk about this horrific crime without getting emotional. You must have a heart of stone.
KH.
It's a very upsetting case, Bonnie. Do you want to...
BJ.
I'm just fine. Thanks, Ken. Let's go back to our hypothesizing. Why would Christy move the sock that she knows Nate Appleyard has already seen in her car to Melody's school bag full of hair, blood, and blowflies? Why link herself to the evidence of murder in that way? I can't see her doing that. Can't see anyone doing it.
KH.
Then, according to you, the Choppas planted the sock in Christy Reville's car and also later moved it to Melody's school bag?
BJ.
Absolutely.
KH.
So they got lucky twice? Christy Reville left her car unlocked twice, at two very opportune moments for Annette and Naldo Choppa?
BJ.
I don't believe the locking of cars would have been at the forefront of Christy Reville's mind on March 2, 2010. She was devastated to think that her infertility might be permanent, not temporary as she'd always hoped. That was what was going on for her that day. So, yes, I have no trouble believing she might have forgotten to lock her car more than once.
KH.
But
Christy herself says otherwise. She says no matter what state she was in, she always locked her car. On March 2nd, 2010, same as always.
BJ.
I have a theory about that. One I can't prove. I don't believe Christy wants to admit that her best friend, as she saw Annette, her only friend in the world, really, could do that to her. Christy and Jeff still insist their good friends and neighbors, the Choppas, are innocent. It's heartbreaking, really. That's the problem with truly good people, though. They don't see evil. They just don't see it, don't recognize it.
KH.
It was kind of like a mutual acquittal society, right? The Choppas saying the Revilles were innocent and the Revilles saying the same about the Choppas? Not what you'd expect.
BJ.
Yeah, the Revilles naively believed the Choppas couldn't be guilty. The Choppas, meantime, knew the Revilles were innocent because they themselves were guilty as hell.
KH.
In her article, Dr. Allwood also raises the question of why there was so much blood in the school bag when the hair found to be Melody's indicated arsenic poisoning. Did the Choppas poison their daughter to death, or did they kill her in a way that caused her to spill lots of blood?
BJ.
Well, I can't believe I have to point this out, Ken, but the two are not mutually exclusive. You can poison someone and cause them to shed blood. For some reason, Annette and Naldo Choppa changed their minds about the murder method. They started with poison, then made a new plan. I have no idea why. I don't understand the mentality of a parent who'd kill his or her own child or any child, and I'm very glad I don't, frankly.
Chapter 6. October 11th, 2017. I jolt awake. It's light outside. The sun streams in through the windows. I'm on the sofa in my casita. My neck hurts, as if I've slept on it bent, and my mouth is painfully dry. Shit, I must have fallen asleep halfway through the Bonnie Juno clip I was watching. That's the last thing I remember from last night. Bonnie arguing with a talk show host. What was his name? Ken something. I look for the iPad mini and find it on the floor. It must have slid out of my hands while I slept. I turn it on. The battery's down to 23%. I'm going to have to go back to the resort shop at some point and ask Mason for a charger. It's 9:20 a.m. I can't believe I slept so long and so heavily. I check for any further communications from Jess, Ollie, or Patrick. My heart leaps when I see I've got an Instagram comment from Ollie. He's written, "Jess says I have to write something so you know I am okay. I am okay. Talk when you're back on 24:10. Is that still when you're back?" I post a reply. "I'll definitely be back on 24 October, Ol. Can't wait to see you. Love you and Jess so much. XXXX. Still no word from Patrick. He'll have to talk to me eventually, however angry he is. I'll do some talking too. It didn't feel possible before. My brain wouldn't mould my feelings into a coherent form that could be expressed, apart from with a howl of anguish. My mouth wouldn't open. The opposite, I'd feel my lips pressed together tighter whenever Patrick appeared. I couldn't speak, so I ran. I'm not going to email him again. Any further attempt at communication would be a concession I can't afford to make. It's up to Patrick to make the next move. I need water, lots of it, before I can do anything. I go to the kitchen and fill one of the glasses on the counter from the cold tap. Drink, refill, drink, refill. Gradually, I start to feel more human. In the bathroom, I splash cold water on my face and enjoy the feeling of it running down my neck. Looking at my wet skin in the mirror, I think about the green and black girl's swimming costume I saw in another bathroom recently, hanging up to dry, and the rubber swimming cap. Were they Melody Choppas? Why would a girl who's supposed to be dead, who's presumably in hiding, go swimming at a busy resort? Whatever number that room was, there was no private pool attached to it. If Melody swam, she must have done so in full view of other swallowtail guests. I'm reaching for a towel to dry my face when it occurs to me. Something so obvious I can hardly believe I didn't realize sooner. Immediately, as soon as it happened. How could I have missed it? The bathroom. The door. I go to the casita's nearest phone, pick it up and press 0 for reception. A woman answers, expresses the impassioned hope that I'm already having a truly great day, and asks how she can help to make it greater still. I ask for Rihanna. She's not in yet, for which I apologize, but I expect her to arrive at any moment. Can I ask her to call you right back? Would that be okay? Yes, if she could call me back. She sure can, no problem at all. She'll be delighted to do that. That would be wonderful. Thank you. America, land of hyperbolic overstatement. I think of Bonnie Juno's description of Melody's parents, evil monsters. Maybe she's right, and that's what Annette and Naldo Chapa are. But the way she said the words, with such relish, made her sound like a monster, too. Perhaps this is the unavoidable flip side of American overstatement. Have an awesome day, unless you're an evil monster. Juno's excessive makeup in the clip, the smooth orange-beige mask where her skin should have been, her dark pink shiny lips, the bright blue glittery gunk above her eyes, made her look monstrous. So did her stiff, jet-black dyed hair that never moved, and her air of absolute confidence that she was right about every single aspect of the Melody Chapa case. Even seated, she looked a foot taller than Ken, and she kept pulling herself up in her chair in order to glare down her nose at him more effectively. She'd worn heels that were at least 6 inches high for the interview. If I were built like her, I'd wear the flattest shoes I could find at all times. Most women would. I wonder if Bonnie Juno made a decision early in her career to flaunt her height rather than be ashamed of it. If the detectives come back today to interview me, if they believe me and take me seriously, how long will it be before Bonnie Juno finds out that some nobody of a tourist from England is putting forward a story that directly contradicts hers? What if she has her researchers try to dig up dirt on me or attacks me on her show? She seems to be able to say whatever the hell she wants and get away with it. Don't flatter yourself, Burrows. No big US TV show is going to be interested in you. I consider going for a dip in my private pool, but if I do that and Rihanna rings, I might miss the call. Also, I'm starving. I ring room service and order breakfast. Eggs Florentine and English breakfast tea with cold milk. While I wait for it to arrive, I look again at my list of search results from last night. Many of them are YouTube clips of Bonnie Juno that look similar to the one I fell asleep to last night. Those that aren't look to be different versions of the Melody Chapa story. I spot attached to one of the YouTube clips the headline, "Where is Melody's Poggy? Ask Bonnie Juno and Ingrid Allwood." The video's dated June 10, 2010, 3 months after Melody disappeared. I've no idea where Poggy is now, but 2 nights ago he was in room 320-something at the Swallowtail Resort and Spa, Arizona. At least, I think he was. No, I'm sure he was. Sighing in frustration, I tap the white arrow to play the clip. Ingrid Allwood has a round pink face, large grey eyes, seashell earrings and a maroon scarf wrapped around her head. Her piles of blonde curly hair spill over its edges. She's wearing sunglasses with chunky blue wooden frames, but on her forehead, over her scarf, not her eyes. As Bonnie Juno, in red 6-inch heels this time, holds forth, Allwood looks as if she's trying not to smile, as if Juno's nothing but a joke to her. The clip begins with Juno in mid-flow.
BJ.
To speculate when it takes you in a direction you want to go in, but not when it might lead to a conclusion that supports my argument. And you have the nerve to deny you're a hypocrite? Ha! Don't make me laugh!
IA.
That's simply not true, Bonnie. You seem determined to misunderstand me, so I'll explain again. I'm happy to speculate in all directions as long as we're clear. That's all we're doing. You cannot claim to know where this Poggy toy is. It hasn't been found anywhere.
BJ.
No, and neither has poor little Melody's body. And yet that tragic little body, the dead body of a sweet, innocent girl murdered by her own parents, has got to be somewhere, right? And mark my words, when it's found, Poggy will be right there with it, no doubt at all.
IA.
I'm afraid you can't say no doubt about something that hasn't happened yet and may never happen.
BJ.
In my heart, there's no doubt. Annette and Naldo Chapa took Poggy out of Melody's school bag and, wherever they've buried her, they buried him with her. In their twisted minds, putting her favorite soft toy next to her would have represented some kind of comfort. The message, one can only assume, is, "Sorry we killed you, but here, have your favorite snuggle toy as a consolation." It's a horrific kind of warped sentimentality, just beyond appalling to any normal human being, but it's typical of those two monsters. Let them sue me if I'm wrong about them.
IA.
I'm sure they would if they weren't devoting all their resources to trying to find their missing daughter.
BJ.
Answer this. What genuinely distraught parents would fail to express any fears or worries about their kidnapped, beautiful little daughter being interfered with? Being in the clutches of a sexual predator? That is every parent's worst nightmare. It's also one of the main motives for a stranger to abduct a child. Everyone knows this. We all know it. Yet not once, has either Annette or Naldo Chapa expressed to the detective searching for their daughter any fears along these lines. They haven't so much as mentioned the possibility of Melody being the victim of sexual violence.
IA.
Not that you know of.
BJ.
Ask Detective Larry Biedman if you don't believe me. He'll tell you, not once. All of this is well documented. You know I'm not making it up. And let's not forget that the Chapas seemed to hold out no hope at all from day one that poor little Melody would be found alive and well. Nuh-uh. They publicly invited her killer to confess. Oh, they knew that sweet child was dead, no doubt about it.
IA.
You keep insisting there's no doubt, and I believe you feel that way, but you're factually wrong. What you have is a strong hunch and nothing more. You don't, you can't have certain knowledge of any of the things you claim to know. As a psychotherapist, I know that desperate, suffering families are capable of behavior that looks strange to those on the outside. Yes, the Chapa's reactions seem a little off, but you're unwilling to believe just how normal that is.
BJ.
And I suppose I haven't interacted with families that are beside themselves with grief and panic. All my years as a prosecutor in the DA's office in Philadelphia? Believe me, I know what's normal, and what's more, I know what's normal for Philly, my home turf for so many years.
IA.
Parental anguish is the same in Philadelphia as it is everywhere else in America.
BJ.
And so is the lack of it. I know distraught parents when I see them. Annette and Naldo Chapa's reactions, light years away from those of any innocent relative in pain that I've ever encountered.
IA.
So they smell off to you, I hear that. But in relation to the toy, Poggy, your argument is weak.
BJ.
No, it's not.
IA.
All right. So, Poggy wasn't in Melody's school bag when it was found, but it could have fallen out at any point. Christy Reville, crucially, did not see Melody zip up the side pocket she'd put the toy in. So sure, someone might have taken it, but it equally could have fallen out.
BJ.
No, he couldn't. Incidentally, Poggy is a he, not an it. He couldn't have fallen out. You ought to take a look at that bag. The pocket where Melody kept Poggy on school days was deep, and she pushed him right down inside it to make sure he wouldn't fall out. Chrissy Reville watched her do it the day she disappeared before they set off in the car to school. Poggy had never fallen out of that bag before, and he didn't fall out of it the day Melody was taken and murdered. Satisfied? Annette and Naldo Chapa took Poggy out of that pocket to bury alongside their murdered little girl to make themselves feel like good people. It's truly sickening.
IA.
You're being completely illogical. Let's say that's why Poggy was removed from the bag so that he could be buried with Melody, and we should make clear here that Melody has not been declared dead. Her body hasn't been found.
BJ.
It hasn't been found yet.
IA.
But okay, let's say someone killed her and buried her with Poggy to keep her company. I don't see why you think it must have been her parents who did that. In particular, her mother, Annette. Christy Reville, who's been described as like a second mother to Melody, could have had the same maternal impulse, couldn't she?
BJ.
Christy Reville had no motive to kill Melody. I don't buy this childless woman obsessive jealousy line. That's yet another example of how women who aren't mothers are demonized in our society. Blame the barren witch. It's always been the way.
IA.
As a childless woman yourself, don't you think you're more likely to want to blame Annette Chapa, the mother who was always too busy to look after her own child and so subcontracted out her care to a neighbor, than to blame Christy Reville?
BJ.
No, I don't think that. You think that. Thank you for suggesting that my childlessness has impaired my judgment. It hasn't. There's no evidence that Christy Reville was ever jealous of Annette Chapa. She never tried to hang on to Melody for that little bit too long or anything like that. I've interviewed many of her friends and acquaintances who all report that her attitude to little Melody was healthy and normal as far as they could see. Christy, according to all who knew her, was obsessed with having a baby of her own. She didn't want Melody. And she liked Annette Chapa. She wouldn't have harmed that family. She didn't. Categorically did not. I'd stake my life on that. The truth will come out one day, and then everyone who's vilified poor Christy Reville will be sorry. And everyone will see Annette and Naldo Chapa the way I see them. I mean, for pity's sake, these are parents who have framed photos of the baby they lost all over their home. Their dead daughter, her dead body. I'm sorry, but that is in no way normal behavior. Imagine how little Melody must have felt seeing those pictures all the time. Oh, and what about the leaked email from Annette Chapa to another school parent in which she speculated that Jeff Reville might be gay and that's why he and Christy weren't making babies? Who do you think leaked that? Annette Chapa, of course. She wants to appear to be sticking up for the Reville's innocence while secretly spreading a very different message. Look, possible sexual deviancy here. We still live in a deeply homophobic world, and... Yes, sadly, we do, but wait. That makes no sense, what you just said. If Melody were a boy and not a girl, maybe, but... Are you saying Annette Chapa thinks people will be more likely to believe in the Reville's guilt if she can persuade them that a gay Jeff Reville, who would presumably desire men or boys, would kidnap a little girl? How does that work?
BJ.
It's simple. There's a lot of closed-minded people out there, disgusting bigots who equate homosexuality with pedophilia and pedophilia with the snatching and harming of children. Plus, Jeff Reville is categorically not gay, so you gotta wonder why Annette Chapa would choose that moment with her daughter missing and her and Naldo apparently distraught to indulge in such malicious and groundless gossip. And going back to the many photos of Emery Chapa dead and all dressed up like a doll on the family mantelpiece where photos of Melody should have been, can you explain the terrifying false equivalence employed by Annette Chapa when talking about her two daughters? I've watched every interview she's given at least 20 times. Have you?
BJ.
Answer? No, you have not. That's okay. Not everyone's as obsessive as me. Every single interview that woman has given, almost since being told she needs to act like she thinks Melody might still be alive, she's talked about how Melody should be back at home where she belongs, how she should be with her mommy and daddy who love her so much. Staggeringly, she talks about Emery who never lived, who died in utero in exactly the same terms. Emery should be here now with me and Naldo to give us love and support. For pity's sake, what mother would wish her tragically deceased baby back to life to comfort her after the loss of her other child? Who cares that poor Emery would then have to be in pieces over her missing younger sister, right? As long as she's there to make her mother feel better. Do you honestly not see how unwholesome and dysfunctional that is? In another interview, Annette said, Emery should have been with Melody the day she disappeared. Christy should have been dropping off two little girls at that school, not one. If Emery had been there like she should have, she'd have seen what happened to Melody. Then she corrected herself and said, what I mean is Emery would never have let anything happen to Melody. What do you mean she corrected herself? To cover up what exactly?
BJ.
To give the impression that the fantasy that had just leapt into her mind was one where the focus was on saving Melody. But it wasn't. It was all about Emery. Emery being alive, going to school, as she should be. As she would be if she hadn't died. That she might have saved her sister was clearly an afterthought. This is what I mean by false equivalence. In Annette Chapa's twisted world, the loss of a child you've known and raised for 7 years is on the same level as the loss of a baby in the late stages of pregnancy. I know I'll be called a monster for saying this, and I'm not in any way trying to minimize the agony of late-stage miscarriage or stillbirth, but come on! What mother in Annette Chapa's situation, what innocent mother, would choose to talk on live television for even a second about the baby she lost 8 years ago when she could spend all her airtime talking about Melody? She feels the two losses as comparable. That's my point.
I
see that, but I'm afraid that you and I, as women who have never lost a baby during the third trimester...
BJ.
Oh, please, ask a dozen women who have lost babies late in pregnancy and then gone on to have healthy children who get abducted or harmed in some way. Ask them if Annette Choppa's reaction, constantly putting forward the loss of Emery, taking attention away from Melody, is normal. Or I can save you the trouble. It ain't. It's light years away from normal. And how about Naldo Choppa opening the door to Melody's bedroom and saying to Larry Biedman, "This should have been Emery's room. We decorated it for Emery before we lost her." Word for word, first words out of his mouth. That, in my view, says it all. Annette and Naldo Choppa couldn't forgive Melody for not being Emery. Wow. I'm sorry, but you simply cannot say that.
BJ.
I just did, didn't I?
The doorbell of my casita rings, and it's like being pulled from one world to another. I push the iPad away from me, as if I've been caught breaking a resort rule. As a friendly, freckle-faced young man talks to me about the weather and where I'd like him to put my breakfast tray, all I want to do is ask him about Melody. Did he follow the story on the news? Does he think Annette and Naldo Choppa are guilty? I sign for my ex-Florentine and let him go without interrogating him. He looks about 22 and was probably busy in 2010 with the American equivalent of GCSE exams, not glued to TV news and talk shows. Taryn, she's the one I should ask if I want to indulge my new obsession. I try to persuade myself that I want to talk to her and fail. Eating my breakfast, which is delicious and not accompanied by guacamole, I stare at the phone and will it to ring. Come on, Rihanna. Hurry up. I reach for the iPad, telling myself I can't keep doing this all day. I can't read everything. Just one more. This clip looks interesting. Mallory Tondini on Justice with Bonnie, September 2, 2010. The interview that changed everything in the Melody Choppa case. I'm also tempted by Dr. Ingrid Allwood's Melody Choppa theory will blow your mind. Mallory Tondini. I've heard that name before. I think Taryn mentioned her. And what theory did the apparently cautious Dr. Allwood eventually put forward? I click on the Allwood link first and expect to see an article or blog, but I find myself looking at a chat room instead. Or chat forum. I'm not sure what to call it. There's a grid of boxes going down the page, and in each box a different person has left a comment, many responding to comments higher up in the thread. There's a quote from Ingrid Allwood at the top. Three paragraphs. This must be the mind-blowing theory. I'm about to start reading it when my eye is drawn to a name I recognise lower down the grid. McNair. There's a comment from a Lilith McNair. Is she Swallowtail's Mrs. McNair, the old lady who turns up every year, selects a child at random, and decides they're Melody Choppa? And then what? This year she happened to get lucky and find the real Melody at the very resort where formerly she had only found fake melodies. Crazy. I can't decide if the Lilith McNair on the chat forum is bound to be the same woman or if it's too much of a coincidence until I read her comment and all my doubts vanish. It's her. She's written some long-winded nonsense about a spiritual seer, a close friend of hers who had a vision of Melody walking through a field full of flowers, red and yellow poppies. Melody was happy, she claims, beaming and joyful. Dr. Allwood's theory must be wrong, because if she were right, Melody would not have looked happy in the psychic vision. Her soul would not be at peace. I laugh out loud. Mrs. McNair's cousin Isaac also gets a mention here, as does his lymphoma. That must be what killed him. I wonder if he and Mrs. McNair were close, and if somehow that's what started off her obsession with Melody Choppa. Hard to see why it would. A cousin dying of an illness is very different from a little girl murdered by her parents. In her comment, Mrs. McNair explains that in the seer's vision, Cousin Isaac was frolicking in the poppies too with Melody. So this must be a special flowery field for dead people. Then Mrs. McNair puts forward her own theory, that Melody was killed by Mallory Tondini. Having made this claim, she ends a comment, "Think about it. You'll see I'm right." That wouldn't explain why Melody's soul would be at peace in the vision. and I'm an idiot for thinking anything coming from Mrs. McNair could ever make sense. Who the hell is this Mallory Tondini? I can't wait any longer to find out. I close down the chat forum and click on the link to her interview on the Bonnie Juno show. So this is what the show's set looks like. A black and silver studio with two red chairs and Justice with Bonnie emblazoned across a large screen behind them. Bonnie Juno's sitting in one of the chairs, wearing high-heeled black boots and a silver dress. I assume the woman in the other chair is Mallory Tondini. She looks about 30 and has a large forehead and an unusually high hairline. Her long dark hair is held back by some sort of clip on one side and hangs loose on the other. She's wearing clothes that are so dark and undefined, it's impossible to see what they are. But it's not only clothes that are covering her. Captions in square and rectangular boxes and strips of all colours, blue, red, grey, yellow, take up most of the bottom half of the screen. All the writing is white, and some of it's in capitals. Are Melody Chopper's parents facing imminent arrest? Breaking news! Startling new evidence in Melody murder case! Help us to find Melody. Have you seen her? Call this number. How could they get away with calling it a murder case and at the same time asking viewers to help find Melody as if she's alive? The contradictions in this case are dizzying. I came to Arizona to try and sort my head out. Thinking too much about Melody Chopper isn't helping. At all. I make a decision. I'll watch this one last clip, and then that's it. No more of this mind-bending true crime story for me. Dead or alive, Melody's nothing to do with me, and I can't afford to think about her any more. I've got a more important mystery to focus on. What's going to happen next in my own life? What's going to happen to my marriage and my family? Only I know this mystery exists. Only I care about solving it.
BJ.
So, those of you who follow the show know that I promised you a special guest tonight, and here she is. Welcome, Mallory Tondini.
MT.
Thank you, Bonnie.
BJ.
Speak up if you want to be heard, sweetheart. How do you feel about being live on Justice with Bonnie?
MT.
A little overwhelmed?
BJ.
Well, please know you're very welcome here. In fact, I can't remember when I was last so delighted to welcome a guest to my show. Ladies and gentlemen, what you're about to hear Ms. Tondini say is going to change everything. And I bet I don't need to tell you this, but I'm referring, of course, to the tragic case of poor little Melody Chopper. Wait, did I say it would change everything? Correction, Ms. Tondini's testimony already has changed everything. Why don't you tell us where you spent this morning, Ms. Tondini, and with whom?
MT.
Please call me Mallory. I spent the morning with Detective Lawrence Biedman.
BJ.
That's Larry Biedman, lead detective in the Melody Chopper case?
MT.
Yes.
BJ.
And in a moment, we're going to hear what happened when Mallory spoke to Detective Biedman, but first, I need to give you all a bit of background. As I'm sure the whole world knows, and I've never spoken about it publicly until now, I had a breakdown in June that caused me to be absent from this show for 2 months. There were many contributing factors, my obsessive, driven nature for one, mea culpa on that score. Then there was my despair at the refusal of detectives to take seriously my strong suspicion that Annette and Naldo Chapa were monsters and wholly responsible for whatever had happened to sweet little Melody. There was my vile ex-husband, Raul Juno, who chose a moment when he knew I was suffering extreme professional stress and public vilification to reveal to the world certain matters that were deeply embarrassing to me and that I would have preferred to remain private. The final straw that led to my breakdown was being arrested for disturbing the peace when all I was trying to do was extract an apology from my former spouse, an apology he still owes me for his despicable behavior. I'm sorry for crying, Mallory. I apologize to the viewers at home also. The last thing I want is to make this about me and my personal heartaches.
MT.
Do you want to...
BJ.
No, I'm fine to keep going. This is important. In my darkest hours after the breakdown, when I lay in bed unable to get up or speak to anyone or do anything productive, well, I had a lot of time to think. I went over every painful event of the previous few months, torturing myself with the memories. One of those memories was a discussion I had on live television with the extremely dubious Ingrid Allwood. That conversation sickened me at the time and continued to sicken me long after it was over. Lying in my bed, I kept replaying it, as if I could somehow make it come out differently, make Allwood see sense. In my head, I pleaded with her, "Can you honestly claim that a mother who is innocent of murder and truly regrets the loss of her daughter, would that mother use interview after interview to say that 8 years ago she had also lost another daughter? Would she talk about the two losses as if they were comparable? Wouldn't she be solely focused on Melody at that point? Now, you all know what answer I'd give to that question, but that's not the point of what I'm trying to say. The point, ladies and gentlemen, is the number 8. 8 years ago, that's when Annette Chapa lost her first baby, Emery. 8 years ago. When I realized what that meant, I sat bolt upright in bed. Suddenly, I saw it. Hand on heart, I believed that the Lord granted me that insight to save me. Without it, I might have stayed in bed forever. Thank you, Lord. Now, you all at home, you don't know what I mean by any of this yet, and you don't know how it relates to Mallory here, but you very soon will. Mallory, why don't you tell us where you live and work and what your job is?
M.T.
I live in Philadelphia, and I work for the Perinatal Bereavement Program at the Hahnemann University Hospital in Philadelphia.
B.J.
So, you work with women who suffer late-stage pregnancy loss, correct? You offer a counseling program?
M.T.
I do.
B.J.
And that's how you came to be acquainted with the Chapa family?
M.T.
Yes, Annette Chapa was due to have her first baby at the Hahnemann Hospital.
B.J.
That's Emery.
M.T.
Yes, but she lost the baby quite late in the pregnancy. In those circumstances, the team I work for offers counseling.
B.J.
And did the Chapas take you up on your offer?
M.T.
Yes, they did.
B.J.
All right. Now, in a moment, I'm going to share with the viewers at home the realization I had as I lay in bed in a state of emotional and psychological agony. But first, Mallory, I'd like to ask you to give us some concrete facts, some dates. As someone who works at the Hahnemann Hospital, you've been able to verify these dates. So tell us, when would Annette Chapa have had her first baby, little Emery, if that pregnancy had gone to term?
M.T.
If she hadn't died, Emery Chapa would have been born May 10th, 2002. A C-section was scheduled for that day.
B.J.
And Melody Chapa, she was born by C-section at your hospital. When?
M.T.
January 11th, 2003.
B.J.
And no one knows this better than you, Mallory, because...
M.T.
In a situation like the one the Chapas were in, we offer additional counseling in the event of a second pregnancy. We offer to be with them for the birth because obviously it can be...
B.J.
Of course. And did Annette Chapa want you at the birth of her second daughter?
M.T.
She did. She and Naldo, we'd grown quite close by this point. They both wanted me to be present for Melody's birth, and... I came on the show to say I don't think they would have ever harmed their own child. I know they didn't.
B.J.
For the time being, please just answer the questions I ask you. So, Melody was born alive and well at the Hahnemann Hospital on January 11th, 2003, which means she was conceived when? When did Annette Chapa become pregnant with her second child?
M.T.
Well, it would have been around April the year before.
B.J.
April 2002. 9 months before January 2003. I'm not sure if everybody's figured out what this means, so let me spell it out. Melody Chapa was conceived in April 2002. Emery Chapa, had she not died tragically in utero, would have been born May 2002. This was the startling realization I had, folks, the one that told me to get on up out of my stinking bed of despair, because I can never stop doing what I do. Not now the Lord has shown me he needs me to do this vital work. What I realized was this. If Emery Chapa hadn't died, she'd have been still growing inside her mother's womb in April 2002, almost ready to pop out, which means Annette wouldn't have been able to conceive Melody. Now, I'll put it more bluntly. If Emery Choppa had not died when she did, Melody Choppa would never have existed at all. Mallory Tondini, from the Hahnemann Hospital's perinatal bereavement team, everything I've just said is true, isn't it? Undeniable?
M.T.
Yes, it's true.
B.J.
Thank you, Mallory. And you have my greatest respect for agreeing to come on Justice with Bonnie when we disagree about the likely guilt of Naldo and Annette Choppa.
M.T.
Bonnie, I only agreed to be on the show because Annette Choppa asked me to. She was afraid you'd distort the picture, and she wanted me, as someone who understands her and understands what she'd been through, to try to put the facts in context.
B.J.
What she wants is for you to defend her in spite of the facts. I get it. But let's not lose our focus on those dates we've just gone over, ladies and gentlemen at home. Those dates matter. Boy, do they matter. Let me tell you why. When I replayed the argument I had on live television with Ingrid Allwood in my mind, when I heard myself say that the Choppas had lost Emery 8 years ago, it suddenly struck me. Melody was 7 when she disappeared, when she died. If Emery would have been 8, I thought that's not much of an age gap between them, hardly any at all. Wait, Bonnie, I said to myself. What if Melody couldn't and wouldn't have been conceived unless Emery had died? Think about it, folks. Think about all the times you've seen Annette Choppa on your TV saying that Emery should still be here, should be comforting her parents in their hour of pain and need, should have been dropped off at school by Christy Reville the day Melody disappeared. Think about Naldo Choppa showing Detective Larry Biedman the bedroom of his missing daughter Melody, and the first words out of his mouth are, "This should have been Emery's bedroom." That's an awful lot of should from the Choppa parents. It's crystal clear, isn't it? They're furious that Emery isn't around anymore because she should be. They desperately want her to be. That much is clear.
M.T.
But, Bonnie...
B.J.
No buts, Mallory. I'm sorry, but any fool can see it. If Annette and Naldo Choppa think Emery should still be alive, that has to mean that they don't believe Melody should have ever been conceived. This is why I had my people find out where Melody was born, and it's how I came to meet Mallory here. I wanted to ask her a very specific question, not one about the Choppas this time. A more general question that would finally provide me with the proof I needed to make the police sit up and take notice. Now, Mallory, you and I first met 10 days ago, didn't we? And what you told me put a great big smile on my face. Not only were you in the room when little Melody Choppa was born, but you'd known the Choppas for some time. You gave them counseling after they lost Emery, their first daughter. When I heard that, I cried out, "Well, thank you, Lord," out loud, right?
M.T.
Yes, you did.
B.J.
And then I asked you a question. Do you remember what it was?
M.T.
You wanted to know when Emery would have been born if she hadn't...
B.J.
Oh, sure, but that's not what I mean. For those viewers only just joining us, we've already established that if Emery Choppa had not tragically died in the womb, Melody couldn't have been conceived when she was and would therefore never have been born. But Mallory, what did I ask you next? I want our viewers to hear this from you, not me.
M.T.
You asked if it was common for a couple to lose a pregnancy, for a pregnancy to miscarry, and then for them to get pregnant again during the time when they would have been still pregnant with the baby they lost.
B.J.
Okay, that's quite a tongue twister, isn't it? But I hope everyone can follow what we're saying. If Emery hadn't died, Melody wouldn't have lived. That's simple, right? I figured that must happen a lot. I haven't been blessed with children myself, but I wanted them oh so desperately for oh so many years, you have no idea. When I was married to my ex-husband, the vile and ruthless Raul Juno, don't get me started on him, I conceived twice. I lost both babies, one at 10 weeks, one at 13 weeks. Heartbroken doesn't begin to cover it. On both occasions, I said to Raul, "Let's try again. Please, let's not give up." Both times, I could easily have gotten pregnant again. I didn't. But I easily could have before the baby I'd lost was due to be born. So I figured that had to be pretty common for that to happen. Mallory, what answer did you give me?
M.T.
What you just said, it's common. Many women conceive soon after losing a baby, during what would have been their prior pregnancy had that not failed.
BJ.
Uh-huh. And you and your team, your colleagues, you support these women through these subsequent pregnancies, don't you? When they're nervous, the same thing might happen again, that the pregnancy might not make it all the way?
MT.
I do, yes.
BJ.
So you're a real expert. Next, I asked you if women in that position, in Annette Chapa's position after Melody was born, a healthy, live baby, do such women ever remark upon the fact that they wouldn't have this beautiful, new, living, breathing baby in their arms if they hadn't miscarried their previous pregnancy?
MT.
Yes, they do.
BJ.
What, sometimes? Often? Rarely? Let's get some context here.
MT.
Almost always.
BJ.
I'm sorry, Mallory.